what distressed me was that among people and in a culture which professes tremendous excitement and loyalty to Jesus, there seems to be so very little attention paid to what Jesus actually had to say. Everybody has a view on the humanity or the divinity of Jesus. Everybody wants to know about the historical Jesus. But it's all about Jesus, and it would be as if he came to be the great celebrity, or worse, the great Bible teacher.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulabane. This week, longtime Harvard professor and pastor Peter Gomes talks about his new book, The Scandalous Gospel of Jesus. Don't be misled by the title. Anyone looking for gospel gossip might be disappointed. Gomes says that the scandal comes from the focus on what Jesus would do, when the real question might be, what would Jesus have me do? Gomes wrote two previous bestsellers, The Good Book and Sermons. He doesn't pretend that following the gospel is easy. He says, quote, "It may be scandalous if we actually tried to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, love our neighbors. Those are dangerous things." This reading of The Scandalous Gospel of Jesus took place in November of 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to discuss the substance of my new book. And I think I must begin with a confession and an explanation. The title, The Scandalous Gospel of Jesus, is not mine. I did not choose it. I was quite prepared, and had been for some years, to call it The Good News, From the Bible to the Gospel, which I thought said essentially what we were about here. The publicity department at Harper's, however, said, boring, boring. And I foolishly put up some mild resistance. I said, the word scandal in American usage implies sex, no matter how you slice it. And so people who are used to the bones of Jesus and the wives of Jesus and the children of Jesus would expect something of this sort, that I have actually found natural family hidden away somewhere, and I have written about it. The publicity department said, Reverend, you write the books, we'll sell them. Which I took to be a suitable rebuke, and I left them to their devices. So any of you who are looking to buy this book in the hope of filling out the more particular genealogy of Jesus, or continued relationships with Mary of Magdala, or even Martha for that matter, or John, for that matter. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but this book doesn't deal with those particulars. I argue that there's enough scandal in the gospel of Jesus to keep our activities pretty high and our blood pressure up there. And I would argue that, indeed, if what I propose is done, that is, if we take the content of Jesus' preaching more seriously than we take Jesus himself, we would have a lot emptier churches. A lot of people say, well, this is not for me, and off they would go somewhere else where they'd probably be better off, and so too with the church. But that's another story. That's another book for another time. I've been doing a fair amount of this talking to audiences of informed and intriguing strangers such as yourself. One of the questions that I was asked, in fact, today was, who inspired you to this book, or what inspired you? Because there's always supposed to be a muse behind our book. And I had to confess, I was not inspired by anybody. I was depressed by the state of the church, the state of the clergy, and the state of the believing public. And so I thought I would try yet again, one more time, to try to sort out that anxiety and depression I had. Some people jog when they're depressed. Some people play tennis. I write books, and they represent a level of frustration. And when I finished, I feel moderately better, especially if there's been a decent advance, which there was here, and sales seem to be up there. That does help a lot to drive away dull care and depression, so on and so forth. But what distressed me was that among people and in a culture which professes tremendous excitement and loyalty to Jesus, there seems to be so very little attention paid to what Jesus actually had to say, the content of Jesus' preaching and teaching. Everybody has a view on the humanity or the divinity of Jesus. Everybody wants to know about the historical Jesus. Everybody is remotely interested in the hidden gospels about Jesus. But it's all about Jesus, and it would be as if he came to be the great celebrity, or worse, the great Bible teacher. I hasten to say that what Jesus came to do is described accurately in the Gospels, where it says he came to proclaim the glad tidings, the good news, the gospel. And so if there's a clue to what we're supposed to be paying attention to, it is called the gospel. And how then do we deal with and treat and discover the gospel in a tremendously over-saturated Bible culture? Everybody is an expert on the Bible. It's still the best seller. Everybody has one. I have checked on my tour, and the Gideons are still at it. Every drawer I open, they have been there. And there is a Bible available for us, and we're free to do with it as we will, presumably. It is read out every Sunday in churches all across the land. I watch the television. There are Bible preachers everywhere. It's very exciting. No wonder people like Christopher Hitchens are so upset and angry. The Bible is still out there, and an awful lot of people appear to be investing in it. But my suggestion here is, in some way, the fascination with the Bible may be misplaced. I remember an article by Edward Farley, professor of theology at Vanderbilt, who said in an opening talk to ordinary first-year divinity students, "Remember, you're to preach the gospel, not the Bible." And I've often thought about the great distinction between the Bible and the gospel. I take the Bible very seriously. Don't you go out of here and misquote me. Don't go out and say that guy from Harvard slams the Bible. I do not slam the Bible. The Bible is a very important thing, but it points to something beyond itself. It is to its source, or the thing toward which it points, what a roadmap is to a destination, or a light post to a darkened particular spot on the street. So it seems to me, if you want to go to Chicago, you will consult a map that will tell you how to get there. You don't end up worshiping the map. You don't end up gilding the map. You use the map to take you where you would like to go. And if it's a good map, it will have all sorts of proven paths and suggestions for your getting to where you want to go, ultimately. Now, all preacherly analogies are untidy. You've all been to church enough to know that none of these hold all the water we put in them. That's why we have so many, because when we've run out of this one, we'll move to another one, and we don't have to have it all depend. The roadmap analogy, I know, is not exact, but it's useful to suggest that the whole point of the Bible is not to be fascinated and obsessed by the Bible, but to look where to go where the Bible points. And as far as the New Testament is concerned, and the teachings of Jesus in particular are concerned, I would argue that the Bible is a means, a directional signal toward that larger other thing known as the gospel, the good tidings. The New Testament is full of interesting stuff, and I'm fascinated by it. It's my meat and drink. It's the stuff by which I earn my bread. And I have never run out of things to say based on what I've been able to find in the Bible. Even the lectionary writers have not quenched my enthusiasm or the capacity to discover things, though they have tried very hard, I must say. But what is fascinating to me is, where does all that stuff point? To what does it appeal outside and beyond itself? And I think that's an interesting question, because we Christians, by and large, have spent so much time, blood and treasure, trying to squeeze meaning out of every jot and tittle in Scripture, that most of us are exhausted by the time we come to the point where you say, well, all very interesting, but so what? Where does that go? Where does that lead us? My predecessor in the Memorial Church, George Arthur Buttrick, a prince of the pulpit in his day, if ever there was one, was famous for criticizing students in his preaching class. He would hear the sermon and he'd say, that was a very good exegesis. Wonderful handling of the text. Those illustrations were first rate. And I thought you managed to make the points you made as well as anybody could make them. But, there was a big but, his right hand would quiver and so would his voice. But where's the gospel? Where's the good news? He didn't mean, where's the happy ending? George was a Presbyterian, didn't believe in happy endings. But what he meant was, where does this story take us beyond the mere text? Where do we go beyond how the prodigal son turned out, or how the Good Samaritan did what he had to do? Where is the larger case toward which this story directs us? And since Jesus himself is described as a preacher and teacher or proclaimer of good news, just what was so good about it, and what was it? And is good news necessarily good news for everybody? Or is good news for some of us bad news for some of you? These are the kinds of questions that we should be asking. I think they would make our preaching much more interesting and challenging. And they would make our study of the Bible, so-called, because I often think it is not study but massaging of the Bible, it would make our encounter with the Bible that much more interesting. There is a kind of supertext. There is a kind of larger context to which Jesus himself is obviously appealing, a new and different standard. And what we have in the New Testament are the illustrations of how that new and different standard would work in this world. Now, we have ended up being fascinated with the mechanics of those stories and the very narrow theological circle within which they would appear to operate. And we have had many examples of a desire to create a Bible culture, a Bible society, biblical values. I'm not altogether sure what that means. I mean, if you're in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, a biblical culture is very different from this one. For some, it would be a very pleasant age of pluralism with wives and maybe even husbands, and if you want to really be equal. All sorts of cultural phenomena of a nomadic Semitic culture. That's a sort of Bible land. I remember when I was a young man, I first went to do duty at Chautauqua. Any of you ever done duty at Chautauqua? I say duty because it's hard work there. The place is full of the most purposeful people I have ever met. They dog you morning, noon, and night, and they're going to get their money's worth if it kills you. Now, on the shores of Lake Chautauqua, as recently as last summer I saw, there is a little reconstruction of Palestine, the Bible land. And you can sort of walk, you feel like Gulliver walking through Palestine, but nevertheless, there it is. And for many people, that is Bible study. If we could just recapture that ancient world and walk the streets where Jesus walked and sit on Gennesaret's shore and do all of that sort of thing, that's sufficient. Well, it isn't sufficient. I wouldn't want to live back there, and if you did, I certainly wouldn't want to live there with you. So there has to be something else. Jesus was not celebrating his contemporary culture. He was not, as so many of our preachers today do, say, this is the best of all ages, and aren't we fortunate to be here? Nowhere in Scripture can I find any allusion to self-satisfaction with space and place and time. No, what Jesus seems to be doing more and more, as we come to know more and more of what he says, is indicting the present on the basis of some larger standard, some other standard. And that other standard is what I am calling the gospel, the good news. Thus, the short thesis is, if you spend all your time in Bible land, you'll never get to the gospel. It's as simple as that. Now, how does this gospel business work? I mean, it's hard enough to persuade people that the Bible is important and they ought to be dealing with that. How do you go beyond that to this rather, at the moment at least, vague concept of what the gospel is all about? Well, let me illustrate, or at least try to. Not too many years ago, I had the great pleasure of being on sabbatical at Duke University. I love Duke University. I call it St. Nicotine's. It's this big statue of James Buchanan Duke out front of the chapel with a cigar in his hand. And we all know where their money came from, and they're not ashamed of it, and I think it's interesting. But it's a wonderful place to be. And the chapel is filled to the doors every Sunday. That's also gratifying, very exciting. I met many Southern Baptist preachers and other Southern Christians of a certain age, that is to say my age or older, who said somewhat, I won't say with a sense of bemusement, but with a sense of bewilderment. They said, when we were young and growing up in the South, it was clear to us that every preacher understood that our social system of racial segregation was ordained, blessed, and approved by God, and could be justified by the appropriate verses in the Bible. They said, we grew up with that. They said, not a single book has been added to the canon, not a single verse has been taken out, nothing has been retranslated, and yet nobody today would say that. What happened? And I said, I must confess to this, I said, it seems to me that the Bible people got a hint of the gospel, that the Bible for a moment was eclipsed by the good news. And somehow once that good news got a hold of you, or you got a hold of it, things would never, nor could they ever, be the same again. Now, you could justify almost anything you want to do with a verse and a chapter in the Bible. That's why we have so many churches in America, because that's what people do. And the greater question is, to what extent do these verses and points of view relate to that larger context of what Jesus called the good news? Take any of the famous illustrations that Jesus used to make his points, the parables. Now, there have been many forests destroyed in trying to make sense of the parables. I sometimes think Jesus could have used an editor, or at least a better editor than the one he had, because the parables aren't all that they are cracked up to be in terms of clear illustrations. And when you do begin to understand them, you don't like them. So it's a very difficult form, this parable form. And you can understand the disciples when they say, will you, for heaven's sake, Lord, please tell us what you mean? Is this what you're meaning to say, or is it something else? And, of course, Jesus is less than helpful in trying to sort things out. But they all appeal to a standard that has not yet become normative. Have you ever noticed that? They all appeal to a moral reality which has not yet become the cultural or the social or the political consensus. And they are consistent in doing that, whether it is expecting greater things from God with the feeding of the 5,000, or the water turned into wine, or whether it is dealing with strangers and showing hospitality and redefining the nature of neighbor, which you find in the story of the Good Samaritan, or is it an essay on how sons should relate to their fathers, or is it really an essay about the nature of the father's love, which, of course, is the story of the prodigal son, which should properly be renamed, and I'm sure you all will do so, The Waiting Father, because it's not about the boys. It's about Papa. So every one of the stories that Jesus uses invokes a will that is not yet, invokes a standard that has not yet come to pass. He's not saying, by this story, I ask you to go back to the ancient truths of our fathers. In many ways, he is saying, our fathers got it wrong. There is no ancient truth. There is a new truth, a truth yet to be determined, and that truth is good, and I call it the good news, and maybe that's the way we should be going. So that has always motivated me and moved me to think of the New Testament not so much as a book of history or even sociology, but far more as a book of prophecy. It has much more in common with the book of Revelation, which I regard as a slightly crazy book, but that's all right. It has much more to do with that than it does with the book of Kings, for example. It is an effort, this New Testament, especially as Jesus, as the words of Jesus are recorded in it, it has much more to do with a world that has not yet come into being, as opposed to a world that once was and which has fallen on bad times. So this leads me to my first politically calculated, outrageous remark. I therefore cannot understand what the term religious conservative means, because what is there to conserve? We haven't got there yet. We haven't experienced yet. The Christian ideal is in the future. It has never yet appeared on earth. So what is there to hold on to with all of our might in the imagination, false imagination in my opinion, that we once had it? Is it the contemporary culture which ended up crucifying Jesus? Is it the high medieval culture with its arrogance of church and state? Maybe you're referring to the Puritans of Massachusetts, those enlightened and reasonable people who were so happy to have all the opinions possible. Or maybe you're thinking of some contemporary theocratic model or ideal. I always ask, if we are going to have a land full of Ayatollahs, whom shall we choose? Who will be our Ayatollahs? There's nobody on television that I can think of from whom I would take advice on anything serious or substance. And maybe Joel's nice. I like Joel Osteen. He's a good fella. But I don't know as I'd want him directing my everyday affairs. And I think we'd all have questions about that. So the point for me, the point of departure is the gospel is yet something that has not been experienced. It is something to which Jesus urges us to aspire. It is at the heart of such of Jesus' classical utterings as the Beatitudes and certainly the Lord's Prayer, where the prayer is uttered for the present tense, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. It doesn't say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done as it once was. It doesn't say that at all. It says, as on earth as it is in heaven, which is a standard almost impossible to achieve, to wit the fact that we have never yet achieved it. And so I was interested in not furthering the discussions about the nature, the two natures of Jesus. Is he divine or is he human? I'm not all that fascinated by the historical Jesus. I know about that. I can talk about that if anybody wants to. I've taught that subject. We know about the historical Jesus, but that isn't the thing. It strikes me that the engaging moment is the content of what Jesus had to say. And the fact is that it is as dangerous, maybe even scandalous now, as it was when first uttered. Take, for example, the fact that Jesus spends a great deal of time talking about money. Now, you are all interested in sex. Every church I know spends all of its time nowadays talking about sex of one sort or another. General conventions, annual meetings, triennial gatherings of ecclesiastical bodies. You think they spent all their time in the X-rated sections of their local bookstores. I notice there isn't one here. But in certain places, you'd think that that's all they did. Jesus, for reasons that have escaped us so far, seems happily unengaged. I won't say uninformed, but I will say not engaged on the subject of sex. But there's a lot to say about money. So do everybody else have things to say about money. And as soon as you start talking about people and their money, you're going to get into trouble. You ask any minister who has to face the annual stewardship sermon in November, money matters, money talks, people shift in their seats, they get all pious and holy, bringing profane things to God's house, so on and so forth. It's a lot of nonsense. And if you want to know what you're supposed to do, Jesus has told you. It is not written in a foreign language. It's been translated for a very long time. You know what you're supposed to do with money. Jesus talks also about divorce. That's a very tender subject in certain quarters. To put it mildly, he's against it, not in favor of it. There aren't very many loopholes through which one can leap there reading the words of Jesus. But we seem to prefer to read the words of Jesus, which he didn't speak or write about on the subject of sex, than the questions of money and divorce and other things about which he did write and speak. For every example, when Jesus preaches his first sermon, and I allude to this, I spent a fair amount of time to this, he has been out in the countryside and he's acquired a bit of a reputation. And then he does what we all sort of long to do and are terrified of doing at the same time. He comes home and he preaches his first sermon in his home synagogue. They say, "Come on up here, young man, come on up and join us on the beamer, on the pulpit, on the platform," and he does. And the attendant hands him the lesson for the day, a lectionary lesson from Isaiah. And he reads it, apparently very well, and that's where he should have stopped, but that's not where he stopped. He then proceeded to do what he'd been asked to do, which was to preach, or in the language there, to teach. He says, "Today, this prophecy from the book of Isaiah has been fulfilled in your hearing." Well, that sounds reasonably arrogant and self-serving and so on. So I am the fulfillment of prophecy and so on. And you can sort of tolerate that, even though there were murmurs, we understand, in the commentaries. We know who this guy is. We know about his mother. And we know about Joseph, his father, as it were. We know this fellow has something of a clouded past, a bloated sense of his own importance, but a slightly clouded past. So they listen. You all have something on your preacher. You all think you do. You all know that. So you sort of say, yeah, go on. We know about this. We know about that. That's the setting. Then he goes on. This is where he gets into very serious trouble. He says, "You are not the people you think you are. You are not the people of whom the prophet is speaking in superlative terms. Remember, the word of the Lord came to non-Jews, people very dissimilar to you, very unlike you. Naaman, for example, and the servants, and these various non-Jews to whom God spoke with a kind of clarity that he hasn't spoken to you in some time. So listen with care. Everything is not as it appears to be." Well, when you do that, with any congregation, you run a risk. But when you do it with your home congregation, and they think that they are responsible and have placed you where you are, you run very high risks. And we know just how high the risk was. Because what did they do? They didn't just skip the coffee hour and go home. They seized him and threw him over a cliff. Fortunately, it was probably not a very high cliff. And it was not a fatal blow because there are many more Gospels and many more chapters thereafter. He passed through it unscathed. But that's a pretty violent response to a teaching and a preaching which was designed to stimulate and provoke. I often take that text, if I'm given the choice of a text, at an ordination. I usually say to the young preacher, "Someday you wish you had preached that sermon, a sermon that was so provoking that your hearers would want to do you in, but you won't dare do it. You have been numbed. Your vital parts have been silenced. At your ordination, when they gather around you, most people think they are laying on hands, but what they are in fact doing is removing your backbone. You have to be careful. You have to be careful about that when that happens." Well, mine has already been removed, so I can afford to say that I have tenure. So what are they going to do to me? But I afterwards, I say to the young man, and increasingly young, I say, "Now, listen to what I say, but don't do what I say, you know. We need you in the church. We need you to stick around. The fact of the matter is that the content of the teaching of Jesus, which there are many examples, the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, the conclusions of the parable tales, the commentaries on the law, they all point in a direction away from a self-satisfied reading of scripture or contemporary culture. They all point to something else, and putting that something else together is what I think is the good news. I think that is the gospel. And I think the gospel is the thing that judges everything, including our theology, including our biblical theology. So the great question is not, is it in the Bible or is it not in the Bible? That is the question that our biblical friends like to ask over and over again. That's the wrong question. The right question, at least as far as I'm concerned, is how does this square with the gospel? How does this square with that large penumbra of truth yet to be achieved and realized, which is at the heart of the teaching of Jesus? Now, you'd think this is a pretty simple enterprise, Divinity 101 or Sunday School 102 or whatnot. Well, if it is so simple, how is it that so few people seem to understand it, and so few sermons seem to be based upon it, and that the only debate that seems to be going on is the Bible literally true or not? That's the wrong debate. Those are the wrong terms in which to be engaged. And the fact that there are many thousands and thousands of our brothers and sisters who wish to argue on that subject doesn't make it any more right. The great question, it seems for us, and the only question, in my opinion, that'll have anything to do with the redeeming and the reforming of the body of believers known as the church, is to what degree can we be faithful to the gospel, the teachings of Jesus? To what degree can that notion of gospel help us in our reading of scripture so that we can be as faithful and engaged followers of Jesus in the world as we can be? It strikes me that that is the question that is at the heart of our enterprise, and I am interested in doing anything that can provoke or stimulate that question. That seems to be, when you look at a biblical passage these days and try to make sense of it as we've all been taught, what does it mean now? What did it mean then? How do we know this? And what does it have to do with us? There is another question which we have to ask, and that is, in what way does this story relate to the notion of the good news? Where is the good news in this story? What's good about it? Where does it direct us? What does it provoke us to think about? What does it provoke us to do? It seems to me that's where our intellectual energy ought to be put in Bible study and in an attempt to make more sense of who Jesus is and what Jesus has to say. I don't think any of us really has to be persuaded that paying attention to Jesus is a good thing. I think we would all argue that paying attention to Jesus is indeed a good thing. And therefore, the next observation would be equally sensible. We ought to pay attention to what Jesus said. And if we do that, we come to the heart of this notion that Jesus is not just reciting Bible verses. Isn't it reassuring to you, as it certainly is to me, that Jesus never had to read a Pauline letter? Isn't that good news? I think that's great good news. Jesus never had to worry about what really did Paul mean in Romans. He didn't really have to wrestle with Paul really write Hebrews. He didn't have to deal with any of that sort of stuff. That's for us to deal with. But Paul himself is concerned with the nature of the gospel, the nature of the good news. And it is not just the simplest summary of a theological position. Jesus is Lord. It's not simply the statement of the earliest Christian community, Christ has come, Christ has died, Christ will come again. All of that is true and all of that is useful, but all of that is true and useful because it points to something else that has not yet happened, that has not yet come. I can imagine the state of the world if it tried to reconstruct itself on biblical lines. I can imagine that. In certain cases, we don't have to imagine that. David Koresh and those people down there in Waco were very much determined to try to construct a world based upon a particular way of reading the Bible. And when that whole thing went up in flames, remember, he was working on his definitive, not translation, but commentary on the book of Revelation of things to come. When I was in college at Bates, I happened to know the son of a man who was the head of an institution known as the Holy Ghost and Us Society, Incorporated. Have you ever heard of the Kingdom? The Kingdom was a small eschatological community in Maine, founded by a great Bates graduate in the 1880s, which believed that Jesus was returning to earth as the faith of the believer a long time. But he was coming to a very particular place. He was coming to Durham, Maine. Now, why shouldn't he come to Durham, Maine, as opposed to Waco, Texas, or one of those places in the South where Jesus is always supposed to be returning? My argument was that he was supposed to return to the South because they needed him a lot more. But that may or may not be the case. He could be coming to Hawaii, he could be coming to Northern Canada, but Mr. Sanford believed that he was coming to Durham, Maine. And so, with a group of very devout and true believers, and with a kind of Yankee efficiency, he decided to construct the New Jerusalem to receive Jesus when he came. And all of the measurements, you know, the cubits and all that sort of stuff are in the Bible. And Mr. Sanford went around raising money and getting carpenters and skilled workers to help him build his New Jerusalem. And you could see the outlines of it. Some of it's still standing in Durham, Maine. That was in the 1890s. By the time I came to know the son of the then ruling prophet of the kingdom, he was very much a part of all of this, though like the rest of us, he had to attend chapel 3 days a week at Bates College Chapel, and there wasn't a great deal of talk about the kingdom at Durham, Maine. There was a great deal of talk about the kingdom, but not quite the way he had been brought up. And so I asked him one day, how do you square all this? And he said, well, my heart tells me Dad is right, but my head tells me he's dead wrong. And I said, well, many of us are caught in that kind of a bind. How are you going to manage? Well, he couldn't answer the question, but I think I know. In the long run, the head prevailed. Jesus may indeed be coming to Durham, Maine. But there is something larger than that. One of the things he pointed out to me was the notion of the coming of the kingdom required people to behave towards one another in a slightly different way than they ordinarily would. And that, of course, is the whole energy of eschatology, that ethics and eschatology are related, as Amos Wilder once so wisely said. If you believe, indeed, that Jesus is coming again and will be coming to judge us on the basis of how well we carry out his teachings among one another, that is a very good incentive to get your act together. It's not simply that Jesus is coming, look busy, though that will help. It is a sense that Jesus is coming. Jesus has gone to great pains to tell you what you're supposed to be doing. And Jesus will be interested, to put it mildly, to see how well you do it. There will be an evaluation. This will be on the exam. And it would be wise for us to try to figure that out. He has said, love your enemies. Well, have you tried that lately? He has said, forgiveness is a very important thing. He has said, somebody needs something you have, give it to them. I mean, the whole thing is all written out there. We can't argue, well, we didn't know that. We didn't see that. That was not my translation. Of course it is. It's all there. So if we are interested in who Jesus is, we ought to be interested in what Jesus said, and we ought to try to apply that in whatever way we can to the world in which we find ourselves. G.K. Chesterton once said that Christianity is not a religion that has been tried and found wanting. It is a religion that has been wanted and never tried. And that's not just an aphorism. There is a certain amount of powerful truth there. I've had any number of Harvard students in such prestigious places as the Harvard Business School and the Harvard Law School and the Harvard Medical School and the J.F. Kennedy School, so on, come up to me and say, you know, this religion stuff is great. This Christianity stuff is great. I wish I could afford to practice it. And I said, well, what do you mean? And the business students are the most articulate on this point. They say, well, look, suppose I practice Christian principles in my business and my competition doesn't. I'll be out of business. I said, yes, probably you will be. You'll suffer some reverses. But you'll have eternal life. He said, well, what good is that if I'm not profiting and my balance sheet is... He's got his values a little skewed up. But you get the point. We live in a world which values Jesus but doesn't value what Jesus had to say. We are the only people who, by profession, are meant to do both. We are meant to value what he said, and we are meant to, insofar as is possible, do what he would have us do. Now, that gets me to one more aphorism that appears to be very popular in this city of yours. I understand that in the highest of places and elsewhere, it has been for some time the thing to do or to have something that says WWJD, what would Jesus do? And I have more than once said, if you have any piece of silver or gold with that on it, or a T-shirt or a sweatshirt with that on it, I want you to bring it forward and I want to burn it right here. That's the wrong thing. What would Jesus do? Who do you think you are? Jesus could do all sorts of things. You can't. So when was the last time you turned water into wine? When was the last time you walked on the water? When was the last time you brought somebody back from the dead? Probably a very long time ago, if ever. So what would Jesus do is an excuse to do nothing, and it gives you a pious loop, a pious way out of any responsibility. The question should be, what would Jesus have me do? And that puts the case right where it belongs. You have certain talents, skills, opportunities, means, motive, and opportunities, they say in the law school. And the great question upon which I think we will all be judged is, given what was given to you and where you were at the moment, what did you do? What did you do with what you had? Not what would Jesus do. I mean, Jesus would do the right thing. Being Jesus means you're always doing the right thing. That's great. Hooray for Jesus. But the rest of us who have to cope with circumstances and difficulties and opportunities and resources, that's where the question of judgment comes in on us. How do we use the talents that we have? And it strikes me that we can only be guided and judged in that by the teachings of Jesus and by the appeal to the notion of the good news. We can only afford to be Christians if we are prepared to live in a time that has never yet existed and does not yet exist. That's the great challenge. Any fool can be a literalist. That takes no imagination. It says what it means, and it means what it says. What is that? I mean, that's no context. There's nothing there. The challenge is, can you live as fully and faithfully now with what has been given to you and what is presented before you as Jesus did in his time, not doing what he did, but doing what you are called to do? Seems to me that's the exciting and demanding edge of the gospel. And that is something of the scandal of it, because we know what is involved. We just don't dare do it. He has showed you, O man, says the prophet Micah, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? It's all there. Look it up, Micah 6. That marvelous story where Jesus tells a long parable, a long story about the person who was in prison and the person who was naked and the person who didn't have anything to drink. And when I was in prison, you visited me. And when I was hungry, you gave me food and drink and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's a very long story. It's a very long sermon, as a matter of fact, that the apostles say, well, when were you there? And, of course, the answer is, when you did it to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it unto me. But the part that usually drops out of the hearer's consciousness when the lesson is read out is, and when you didn't do it to any of these, you also didn't do it to me. So what we're meant to do is not a great mystery. It is at the heart of our understanding of the teachings of Jesus. And if there is to be a revolution in our time and in our world, it is that we actually apply what we know to what we do. That's the revolutionary dimension of the Christian faith, and it may be why so many people are afraid to practice it, and it doesn't happen. Trying to reconstruct Bible land, a kind of Chautauquan island, or trying to second-guess every textual nuance in the canon, those are interesting intellectual exercises, but they don't cut the mustard. Where the issue gets drawn is how, where, and when do we apply what we know to be the teachings of Jesus to the world in which we live? How, then, do we measure both the Bible and ourselves by the standard of the gospel? When people ask me, and this is partly facetious but not entirely, people say, well, what kind of a church is Memorial Church? You know, they've already formed an opinion by the way they put the question. What kind of a church is Memorial Church? First, they mean, you know, what kind of denomination is it? Is it a Methodist, a Presbyterian, a Baptist? Or they think I'm an Episcopalian because I can read. I take offense at that. But they ask those kinds of questions because they figure that if they can get the answer, then they'll be able to find what little corner of the great crossword puzzle that is the Christian faith you can stick this thing, and it will be calm and out of risk. And increasingly, I have said, "Why Memorial Church is a gospel church?" They don't quite know what to make of that. Gospel like this, you mean gospel? Like that gospel? And I say, no, like this gospel. Like the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the kind of church we are. That's what we preach. That's what we teach. That's what we try to do. I'm not saying that we succeed, but I am saying that the gospel is communicatable. It is understandable. It is available. And I tell people that on Pentecost, the Feast of Pentecost, and you just read about it in Acts, the whole emphasis is not on the lack of comprehensibility. You have to read that again. I mean, yeah, they're all yammering away and all sorts of strange things are happening and people speaking in tongues. But the gift of Pentecost is the capacity to understand. It is the power of communication. It says each one of them heard in his or her own language the wonderful truths of God. It was the most effective form of evangelism. Pentecostal ecstasy is not the confusion of tongues. Pentecostal ecstasy is understanding, perhaps for the first time and in your own language or argot, what the gospel is all about. And that's why I say we are a Pentecostal church. And that's why I pray for Pentecostal churches. It's why I pray for the true spirit of Pentecost, which is understanding and not simply ecstasy. Maybe I've been in the university too long, but I sort of think that ecstasy is understanding. When I figure out something, I say, hooray, what a great, glorious moment. I don't get ecstatic when I don't understand what somebody's saying. Neither did Paul. Paul has a lot to say about speaking clearly and hearing with the mind and the heart, and speaking with the heart and the understanding. So I'm not changing the meaning of gospel. I think I am rehabilitating it, and I'm urging my brothers and sisters who are looking for ways to rehabilitate the church, to rediscover the gospel. The fact that we haven't done so before is a scandal, and it may be scandalous when we actually try to apply it in our communities. We actually try to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, love our neighbors, pray for the coming of the kingdom, live as if the kingdom were already here. Those are dangerous things. Blessed are the peacemakers. Now, I had a perfect illustration of this in Plymouth, where I come from, a small little town. Everybody knows everybody else's business. It's a kind of our town with an edge, as it were, and a rock. Thornton Wilder would love it. A call went out last spring for anybody who had anxieties, and that was the nicest way of putting it, anxieties about the war in Iraq, to join a little vigil of people in the town square for half an hour who just stood there silently as a silent witness, because there were so many different positions to be represented, they couldn't even pray together, but just stand there. Well, the day came, and I thought, well, okay, I'll see what this is all about. So I went out to join these people. There were about 25 of them, and they were from everywhere, from the synagogue, from the Episcopal Church, Unitarians, a lot of non-church people, and some church people, not very many from my church, the Baptist Church, but that's all right. They're hardworking people. They were elsewhere. So there we stood in the middle of town, and we didn't have any gestures. We didn't, you know, we were visible, but we didn't do anything. We just sort of stood there. And you would be amazed at the amount of abuse hurled at us by cars as they were passing by. The universal symbol of contempt flipped at us at every other moment. Why don't you bastards go back to Hanoi? I said, you're a generation too late, aren't you, Sonny? A little too old to be called Sonny, even. There was a whole anger, and somebody said, we certainly have managed to bring out the worst in these people. And it occurred to me that that is probably what it would be like if we all actually tried to live out the content of Jesus' teaching, if we tried to live the gospel life in this world. Maybe the argument is this world is not yet ready for such a thing. Maybe it can't handle it. But the stronger argument probably is maybe we can't handle it. We as believers can't handle it. But at least we can aspire to it. We could say, there is a great and glorious goal to which we have not yet achieved and we're unlikely to achieve. It's called the gospel. This is what it's about. Maybe there's one or two people out there for whom it might take. And it might make a difference. And what an excitement that would be. This all came about largely because of that phrase of Edward Farley. Don't forget we are to preach the gospel and not Jesus. The reason we preach Jesus is that he preached the gospel. And somehow recovering that at the heart of what we do in church will give, in my view, a fresh and exciting light to everything else that we do. It will give us power and courage to take on the impossible. It will give us security in an age of anxiety, and we will be defined no longer by our fears, but by our hope. And it strikes me that we have been for too long defined by our fears and not sufficiently engaged by the power of our hope. So at the end of this book, I talk about the kind of hope we might long for or yearn for. And I am not one of these hopelessly optimistic sorts of people. I live in the real world. I believe in original sin. I believe in the fall. Those are not metaphors as far as I'm concerned. I just have to look at the mirror and look to the person sitting next to me to know that they're all powerfully true and profoundly affecting the way we live our life. I remember many years ago I invited Alan Payton to deliver a set of lectures in Memorial Church. And I hear some murmurs of recognition of those who come from people of a certain age. You will remember Cry the Beloved Country. An awful lot of people younger than 40 have never heard of Alan Payton or of Cry the Beloved Country. But we were in the middle, when I invited him to come to Harvard, of the powerful anti-apartheid movement, in which I was happy to play a small part. And I got a call from the black exiled leader of one of the strongest anti-apartheid groups of South Africa saying, we are going to tear your church up. And I said, no, you're not, because I will arrest you. I'll beat you up. I'll do whatever it takes. You are not going to tear up my church. You're going to allow this man to speak. He is an old white cracker. We do not need him. And I said, well, you may not, but there are others who do. I think we should allow him his moment. Well, we are all coming. I said, well, you're all welcome, but you better keep quiet or you'll have me to reckon with. So we sort of had this. So there they all were in the gallery. And Dr. Peyton delivered his lecture. And he was a rough old growly lion. And he just sort of snarled through the evening and whatnot and gave a rather grim assessment. And there was what we call a Cambridge lady. There are lots of Cambridge ladies there, living in furnished souls, as you know. And there she was. She had braids and sensible shoes and so on. And father was doubtless a professor many years ago. And she stood up. She said, Dr. Peyton, are you optimistic about anything? No, madam, I am not, he said. He said, I am a Christian, and a Christian is not an optimist. He said, but I have hope. And the distinction he made, optimists hope that everything will turn out all right in the end and are prepared to wait and see if it does. Whereas Christian hope is when things look the worst and they are the bleakest, you are able to stand tall and carry on because you hope in something that is grounded and is beyond the circumstances of the moment. It was a powerful remark. Everybody who heard it that night, I think, came away with a different notion of what optimism and what hope are all about. Optimism is a remarkably American thing. You know, there is the Optimist Club, and there is the whole theology of optimism. Let's look on the bright side. Remember Monsieur Couet? Every day and every way I am getting better and better and better. I think said about 1919. You know, things haven't got better since 1919 by and large. So when things don't turn out the way we want them or expect them to turn out, the mere optimist has nothing to hold on to, nothing to stand fast by, and keels over. The most terrifying example of this is in our common memory. On 9/11, when that struck, a nation of optimists nearly keeled over. The press led the keeling over. Where was God? On the Sunday following, Memorial Church, like all of our churches, had an Easter crowd. People I haven't seen for ages turned out, came to church on the Sunday following 9/11. And you sort of, I just sort of knew why, but wanted to ask out loud publicly why. I decided that I was going to take a slightly different tack. And that's in here as well. I tried to make, again, Peyton's distinction between optimism and hope. And I reminded people that Jesus himself said that in this world we shall have tribulation. And in the Old Testament it tells us, do not make haste in a time of calamity. It assumes that calamity and tribulation are part of the natural order of things. They are. And if your hope is simply that everything will turn out all right, that's not hope, that's optimism. Your hope is that when things don't turn out all right, you will be able to stand against the evil day. And the day after the evil day becomes the most important day in your life. That was not a lesson widely heard or understood in the week of 9/11. And only now, barely, does it raise its head above the parapet. But I am convinced that that is one of the substantial teachings and examples of Jesus, which allows those who love him and bear his name to stand up against anything and everything that happens. Now, if that is not applied theology, I do not know what the term means. I think it is applied theology, and I think it is a scandal that we don't know it and own it any better than we do. So, I've given you a bit of why I wrote the book, what I think it's about. If you buy it or steal it or however you acquire it, you will see that I've been pretty consistent. I begin with a section called The Trouble with Scripture, and I argue that most of our troubles begin with our failure to understand that the Scriptures are meant to offend and that we are called to a life of nonconformity. That's part one. Part two has to do with what the gospel says and what the conventional wisdom tells us. And I give full credit to my late neighbor, J. Kenneth Galbraith, who claimed full marks for inventing the term the conventional wisdom. I'm sure he did. And then the third part is, where do we go from here? And the older of you will be perhaps shocked to discover that I have rediscovered the social gospel. But I say it's an inclusive gospel, and it is a gospel of hope. And then I conclude by telling you what I've just said, as any good sermon should do. So that's what it's about. It's all here, and I'm eager to answer any of your questions or to respond to your lectures.
As far as the good news is concerned, can you comment on what you feel Mark was trying to teach in his gospel by omitting the birth narrative?
I think Mark is simply trying to save time. I don't have a substantial answer to that. I don't know. And the person that I would ask, J. Hardy Ropes, is dead. So I can't explain it. I don't know.
When you began and spoke about the Bible pointing to the gospel, I had an eerie flashback to Ann Coulter's remark to the Jew about we Christians being more perfected than the Jews, and the Jews should therefore convert to be perfected like us. And I'm sure that had nothing to do with what you were saying, but I'd like you to comment on the relationship between Christianity and the Good News and the other religions of the book.
Well, I would argue, I would state unabashedly and unashamedly that I haven't read a word Ann Coulter has ever written, and make a habit of trying to avoid her wherever I can. So I really don't know what she meant, but I would argue that, one, the God whom I worship is God of everybody, not just of the Christians, and therefore has a gospel, a good news for all creation. Now, I don't know what it is, and I can't presume to explain it to my brothers and sisters of a different religious experience. But I have to believe, unless I fail to believe in the central belief of my own faith, I have to believe that God has provided, therefore, and that there is a means for those people to understand what that gospel, what that good news for them is. And our job as Christians is to share our understanding. I do not buy this notion that because there are other traditions, we shouldn't say anything about our own. I think we should say all that we possibly can. I believe in evangelizing. I even believe in mission in some real sense. But I also believe that the author of all of this is someone much vaster and grander than our poor little systems can begin to compare. So my enlightenment, such as it is, may not necessarily be that of somebody else, but it is God who enlightens. There's a wideness in God's mercy, like the wideness of the sea. I believe that. And therefore it means that I must be both modest in relationship to others and charitable in relationship to others as well. Two qualities that haven't gone very well with our Christian enterprise. That I could go on for hours, but I'll stop there.
David Dulles, Dr. Buttrick was a dear friend of mine. Do you believe in the literal, physical, bodily resurrection and ascension of our Lord and Savior?
Yes, I do. Doesn't make any sense, but I believe it. When I was ordained, somebody asked me about angels. What did I believe about angels? And I said, I believe in angels and archangels and principalities and all the starry hosts. And that seemed to be a little bit more than the question I wanted, so he didn't ask me anything else. Sir, what do you want to know?
That's the meaning of faith, is that you believe what you don't have the proof of.
I have no evidence. So.
Right. You said something about kind of a criterion of a functioning church is that you see the fruits of the gospel, you see the feeding of the poor, you see the works.
Yeah.
Right.
I'll answer. I'll affirm your question when I know what it is.
Okay. Well, what I'm leading to, you I think appropriately said, everybody's saying they're Christian, but what do they do? And what I have found is that would lead me to think, well, if you go to church and they're feeding the poor and all that, that ought to be where there's real Christianity. But what I have found is that it's politically correct now to have programs to carry out those functions. I've been in churches, in fact, one where I heard you last speak, where they have these programs, but when you come out among the people, there's a rigidity and lack of joy that I find smothering and awful to be around. Mm-hmm. That I guess it comes from the culture. It says that they will know we are Christians by our love. When I'm around people who are really living the Christian life, there's a joy that is apparent and present. What I also see, though, is that some of the organized churches are become idols. The people, when you go there and there's this, you know, sort of not aliveness, you have to question, well, who do they worship, really? And I find that some of them are worshiping the church. The church has inverted itself on itself and become, you know, its own God.
Well, there is some truth to that celebration of institutions and the notion that we're in this because we have a living relationship with someone who has called us to do this work often gets lost. One of my favorite themes is to preach on joy, which in church is a very rare commodity. George Orwell had a phrase describing the sour aspect of somebody who has no happiness in his or her life. And his line was, "She looks like a woman who has just come back from early communion." And we all know what that sort of face is like. There is a certain sort of determination, a sort of grimness. And you want to say, if you were the only advertisement for the convictions that you have, why would I want to join you? So, you know, I'm not one of these kids of peace types, I confess. I'm a frozen New Englander. I don't like to talk to strangers in church. I tend to say, I didn't come to talk to you, I came to talk to God. But I also know that there has to be a sense of celebratory thanksgiving and achievement for the privilege of being among those who follow Jesus Christ. And I want to be able to communicate that in any way that I can. If it means smiling at somebody I'd rather not smile, I'll do that. If I have to give them a kiss of peace, I'll do that. If I have to shake hands in the middle of the service, I'll do that. But I want to do something that says, look, I believe in this stuff. It is the most important thing I know. And I want you to know I believe in that too. So that's my reading of that. Now, there are lots of, I can tell, there are lots of kiss of pieces around here. And It's okay, so long as it doesn't break out into chaos. There's that wonderful illustration. I can't remember. I think it wasn't Robert Runcie. It was the Archbishop of Canterbury after Fisher and before Runcie, Michael Ramsay with big eyebrows. They had just introduced the Kiss of Peace in the Diocese of Canterbury, in his own cathedral, and apparently early on he just wasn't keen on it, but all the priests in his diocese wanted to give the kiss of peace to their primate and Lord Archbishop. And so he had a little hug here and there in the east end of the choir with whomever came forward. But as the horde started descending on him, he descended to his knees at his prayer desk and he said, "We've had it here, thank you very much, we've had it here, thank you very much." I'm tempted to do that myself. "We've had it here, go away." Don't tell the bishop this. I know he proves, but buy the book. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.